Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, maybe the most influential, certainly one of the most controversial, and maybe fundamentally misunderstood thinkers of the modern era, Sigmund Freud.
Yeah, a huge figure. And we're using, I think, the perfect filter to do it. Anthony Storr's critical examination of Freud. Storr is just a fantastic guide for anyone who wants to figure out why Freud still matters, even if you're skeptical about psychoanalysis as, you know, a hard science.
Right. And that's really our mission today. We want to navigate what Storr sees as the central challenge. How do we evaluate this pioneer? I mean, his specific theories, things like the Oedipus complex, they're often refuted, right?
Oh, definitely. Widely challenged.
But his core insights, they just completely revolutionized how we talk about the human mind. Think about it. Words like ego, repression, neurotic, even Freudian slip, they're just baked into our everyday language. We're all kind of Freud's intellectual heirs, whether we realize it or not.
And Storr helps you, the listener, sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, the genius from the dogma, maybe. The idea is to appreciate Freud's massive contribution without having to swallow whole every complex, sometimes flawed, theoretical system he built.
So hopefully this deep dive gives you a quicker but also a more thorough understanding of his lasting impact on how we think about human motivation.
Exactly.
But before we really unpack the theories, let's talk a bit about our guide here, Anthony Storr. Who was he?
Right, Storr. He lived from 1920 to 2001. He was a really distinguished British psychiatrist, also a clinical lecturer at Oxford University, and a prolific author. You might know him from books like Solitude, which looked at creativity and the need for time alone.
So a respected figure in his own right. But what makes his take on Freud so valuable?
It's his perspective. That's what makes this so useful. He wasn't just an academic looking from the outside. He was a clinician, deep in the trenches, you could say. He had tons of clinical experience with psychotherapy, with psychoanalysis.
Ah, so he was an informed insider. He knew the practical side.
Precisely. He knew what could actually work, what felt true in the therapy room. But crucially, he was also a skeptical outsider. He wasn't part of the, let's say, Freudian establishment. He recognized the need for empirical evidence, for scientific rigor, which, let's be honest, wasn't always Freud's strong suit.
Okay, so he could see the potential healing power, the talking cure maybe, firsthand.
Yes.
But he wasn't afraid to point out where the actual science was, well, lacking.
That's the crux of it. You know, unlike the diehard loyalists who defended everything Freud said, or the purely hostile critics who dismissed him entirely, Storr brought this really balanced, eclectic, evidence-based approach. He was just perfectly suited to give a fair assessment.
So he acknowledges the genuine therapeutic value, while also noting, quite clearly, where the ideas needed major revision, or maybe even just needed to be abandoned. That balance feels really important for understanding Freud today.
Absolutely. It's exactly what you need.
Okay, so let's get into the heart of Storr's book then. What's the central argument he's making about evaluating Freud?
Well, Storr starts by saying, look, Freud's fundamental contribution to understanding the human psyche, it remains revolutionary. No question. The big question is, okay, how do we evaluate him now with everything we've learned since?
He has a framework for that.
He does. A really useful one. He says we absolutely must evaluate Freud on two distinct levels. Level one, Freud is a scientific framework.
And the verdict there?
Storr concludes it largely fails, mainly due to a lack of verifiable empirical evidence and also this really tricky problem of unfalsifiability.
Unfalsifiability?
Yeah.
Meaning you couldn't prove his theories wrong.
Exactly. They were often so broad, so metaphorical, maybe so self-referential, that almost any observation could be interpreted to fit the theory. And if a theory can't even in principle be proven wrong, well, it doesn't really qualify as science in the modern sense.
Okay, hold on. If Storr says Freud failed scientifically, why are we even talking about him? Why bother with this interpretive framework if it's not based on, you know, provable facts?
Because that brings us to the second level. Storr argues we also have to evaluate Freud as a hermeneutic or interpretive system.
Hermeneutic, like a system for interpretation, for making meaning.
Precisely. And here, Storr argues, Freud is a resounding success. A hermeneutic system is essentially a rich, compelling narrative, a mythos, Storr calls it, a kind of master story that helps us make sense of all the irrational, contradictory, often frankly bizarre aspects of human experience. our dreams, our slips of the tongue, our weird compulsions.
So he's like a brilliant storyteller of the inner life. He gave us a powerful vocabulary, a map, even if it wasn't a scientifically validated blueprint of the brain.
That's a great way to put it. Storer sees him as a visionary explorer. His core insight, the one that changed everything, was recognizing the power of unconscious mental processes and just the sheer, tangled complexity of human motivation. Dismissing him entirely because some details were wrong would be just as misguided as accepting him uncritically.
Okay, let's dig into those core insights then. Storer points to one as the single most enduring contribution, right?
Yes. The discovery of the dynamic unconscious mind. Now, the idea of an unconscious wasn't totally new. Flossers had talked about it. But Freud made it central. He envisioned it as this vast active reservoir.
Not just a passive basement, but an active force.
Exactly. Filled with repressed desires, forbidden thoughts, fears, traumatic memories, all constantly pushing, trying to find expression, influencing our conscious thoughts and behavior in ways we don't realize.
And that just shattered the prevailing Enlightenment view of humans as, you know, primarily rational beings in control of their own minds.
Completely shattered it. And for Storer, the evidence for this unconscious activity isn't just in clinical cases, it's in everyday life. Things like slips of the tongue, those parapraxes, the classic Freudian slips that seem to accidentally reveal hidden thoughts or intentions.
Like calling your new partner by your ex's name.
Oops.
Right. Or, more fundamentally, the defense mechanism of repression. This idea that we actively, though unconsciously, push painful or unacceptable thoughts, memories, feelings out of our awareness because they're too threatening. The takeaway is profound. We are not masters in our own mental house, as Freud famously put it.
Okay, so if the unconscious is this chaotic place full of conflict, raw desires clashing with societal rules and our own conscience, how did Freud structure that? Did he literally think of it as a battleground inside our heads?
He kind of did, metaphorically at least. He provided a map. The structural model of the mind. You've got these three competing agencies constantly interacting. First, there's the id.
The id? That sounds primitive. It is. Think of the id as like a newborn baby. Pure instinct. It operates entirely on the pleasure principle. It wants immediate gratification for all its urges, hunger, thirst, sex, aggression, without any regard for reality or consequences. It's just raw, primal drive.
Okay, pure impulse. Then what's checking that?
Well, on the other end, you have the superego. This is essentially your moral conscience. It's the internalized voice of your parents, teachers, society, all the rules, the shoulds and should nots. It strides for perfection, judges your actions, and is the sort of guilt and self-criticism when you fall short. It's the internal moral police.
Right. The demanding infant versus the stern judge who mediates.
That's the job of the ego. The ego is the part of you that has to deal with the external world. It operates on the reality principle. Its job is to try and satisfy the id's demands in realistic and socially acceptable ways that won't get you into trouble or incur the wrath of the superego.
So the id screams, I want that cake now.
Right. And the superego might say, cake is gluttonous. You'll regret it.
And the ego steps in and says,
the ego says, okay, look, maybe we can have a slice of cake after dinner once we've finished our work. It's the negotiator, the executive branch, trying to find a compromise between desire, morality, and reality.
That sounds like a pretty stressful, constant negotiation. No wonder we feel conflicted sometimes.
Exactly. It is a constant internal conflict. And according to Freud, this conflict generates anxiety. To protect the ego from being overwhelmed by this anxiety, we develop and deploy defense mechanisms. And Storer really highlights these as some of the most enduring and clinically useful parts of Freud's legacy, things we all recognize.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Well, the really common ones. Denial, where you just refuse to acknowledge a painful reality. Someone gets a terrible diagnosis and insists the doctors are wrong. Or projection.
Projection.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you see your own flaws in other people.
Sort of. More specifically, it's attributing your own unacceptable feelings or impulses to someone else. So if you're feeling really angry at your friend, but you can't consciously accept that anger, you might unconsciously convince yourself that they are angry at you.
Oh, okay. I see. And what about making excuses?
That's rationalization, a big one. Creating plausible-sounding, logical justifications for behavior that's actually driven by unconscious or unacceptable motives. You splurge on something expensive you can't afford and tell yourself, oh, but it's such good quality, it'll last forever, it's practically an investment.
Guilty as charged. We all do that, don't we?
Absolutely. And Storer also points to sublimation, which Freud saw as a particularly important and mature defense mechanism.
Sublimation. channeling something.
Exactly. Channeling those raw primitive impulses like aggression or sexual energy into socially acceptable, even valuable outlets. Think of a surgeon channeling aggressive impulses into precise cutting, or an artist channeling intense emotions into their work, or someone channeling competitive drives into sports. Freud thought much of civilization was built on sublimation.
Okay, that makes sense. But now, we have to touch on the really controversial stuff, right? The part Storr critiques quite sharply, like Freud's theories on sexuality and human development, the whole oral, anal, phallic stages, the Oedipus complex.
Yes. And Storr tackles this head on. He raises a really crucial methodological point. Where did Freud get these ideas? He critically notes that these very specific, very elaborate sexual frameworks were based almost entirely on his work with a relatively small number of patients.
Okay, patients who were mostly?
Mostly upper middle class, neurotic Viennese women and men living in the very specific, rather repressed, patriarchal culture of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Not exactly a representative sample of humanity.
That's a huge limitation.
So does Storr say we should just throw out everything Freud said about childhood development and sexuality, or is it more nuanced?
It's more nuanced. Storr suggests we need to filter it heavily. He argues that the specific psychosexual stages and the universality of the Oedipus complex haven't really held up to scrutiny. They often seem to reveal more about the biases and cultural assumptions of Freud's time and place than about fundamental, innate human nature.
But is there a core insight there that is still valuable? Yes. The fundamental idea behind it all that our early childhood experiences, especially our relationships with primary caregivers, are absolutely crucial in shaping our adult personality, our patterns of relating, our vulnerabilities. That insight, Storr argues, is profoundly important and has been largely validated by later research, especially in attachment theory. You just have to separate that core insight from the sometimes rather speculative sexual framework Freud draped over it.
Okay, that makes sense. Filter out the culturally dated specifics, keep the core insight about early life. So pulling back a bit, what are the key themes or messages from Storr's analysis that still feel really relevant for us today?
Well, Storr emphasizes a few things that remain, I think, incredibly valid and applicable. First, the therapeutic value of insight and verbal expression.
The talking cure.
Exactly. The whole idea that putting difficult experiences, confusing feelings, and painful memories into words, and developing insight into your own patterns, why you do what you do, is inherently healing. This came directly from Freud and his early work, and it laid the foundation for basically all forms of verbal psychotherapy we have today.
And research backs that up. The power of talking and understanding.
Oh, absolutely. Modern research consistently confirms the therapeutic benefits of emotional expression, narrative construction, and gaining insight into one's own psychological dynamics. Making the unconscious conscious, as Freud aimed to do, really can give you more control and freedom.
Okay, what else?
Second, as we just touched upon, the importance of early relationships. Storr strongly endorses the Freudian insight stripped of the specific Oedipal drama, perhaps that our adult personality, our expectations and relationships, our deepest insecurities are largely forged in those very first interactions with parents or primary caregivers.
And modern psychology agrees.
Massively. Modern attachment theory, which is heavily evidence-based, is entirely built on this premise. It confirms the profound and lasting impact of our earliest bonds on everything from emotional regulation to relationship success later in life. Freud was onto something huge there, even if his explanation was flawed.
Got it. Earlier relationships matter immensely. What's next?
Then there's a bigger, more philosophical theme, especially from Freud's later work like Civilization and its Discontents. That's the tension between instinct and civilization.
Ah, the idea that society forces us to suppress our true natures.
Pretty much. Freud argued, quite pessimistically, that civilization is only possible because we agree collectively to renounce or suppress many of our primal instincts, particularly aggression and unbridled sexuality. We have to curb these drives to live together peacefully.
But there's a cost to that suppression.
Yes. According to Freud, the cost is a permanent underlying state of psychological tension, frustration, and discontent. We're always caught between our animal desires and the demands of social living. It's a really powerful, if maybe bleak, lens for understanding enduring social conflicts, political tensions, and just the general malaise of modern life.
It does sound bleak, but also kind of rings true sometimes. Is there one more key takeaway from Storr?
Yes, a kind of meta lesson, maybe. And that's the danger of theoretical overreach. Freud himself serves as a powerful cautionary tale. He had brilliant, revolutionary core insights. But then Storr argues he sometimes built these vast, incredibly complex, dogmatic theoretical systems on quite limited, often shaky, evidence.
So the lesson is, even a genius can get carried away and undermine their own best ideas by trying to make them explain everything.
Exactly. It warns us about the dangers of becoming too attached to our own theories, of pushing them beyond the evidence, of turning insights into rigid dogma. It's a lesson in intellectual humility, really.
That's a great point. Now, Storr's really good at pulling out these memorable phrases or ideas that encapsulate Freud's thinking. Let's talk about a few key ones. One you mentioned earlier really hits hard. The ego is not masters in its own house.
Mm-hmm. That just perfectly captures the core revolutionary insight, doesn't it? Our conscious awareness, our rational self, the ego, is only a small part of our mental life. We're constantly being influenced, pushed, and pulled by forces we don't fully understand or control: the I's desires, the superego's judgments, unconscious memories, repressed conflicts.
It's a direct challenge to our sense of ourselves as fully rational, in charge beings. Kind of humbling.
It's deeply humbling. It permanently challenges the human tendency towards rationality and self-mastery. We're more complex and maybe more driven by the unseen than we like to think.
Okay, so if the ego isn't master, what's the goal of therapy then? Is there a phrase for that?
Yes, there is. Where Eid was, their ego shall be.
Where Eid was, their ego shall be. Meaning?
It encapsulates the whole therapeutic project in a way. Psychological health and growth involve bringing those unconscious drives, conflicts, and processes under conscious awareness and control. The goal isn't to eliminate the illies, you can't do that, but to understand its demands and integrate them, manage them through the ego's capacity for reason and reality testing. Gaining insight allows understanding to replace blind impulse.
So more self-awareness leads to more conscious choice, more freedom from being driven by those hidden forces.
Precisely. It's about strengthening the ego, making it better able to mediate those internal conflicts and navigate the external world effectively.
And finally, there's that famous line, though. Apparently, it might not even be something Freud actually said, but it captures an important idea.
Ah, you mean sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yes. What does Storr make of that?
Storr uses that idea, whether Freud said it or not, as a really important corrective. It's a reminder against the tendency, sometimes seen in early psychoanalysis, towards overinterpretation, finding deep, hidden, usually sexual symbolism in absolutely everything.
Right. Not every long object in a dream represents a phallus. Not every tunnel represents a womb.
Exactly. Sometimes the surface meaning is just the meaning. It cautions against interpretive zealotry and reminds us to stay grounded. It adds a necessary balance.
That's really helpful. So moving from the theoretical to the practical, how can understanding these Freudian concepts filter through Storr actually help us in our everyday lives?
Well, the great thing about Storr's approach is that many of these insights are immediately applicable. Just recognizing defense mechanisms in yourself and others is a huge tool for self-awareness.
How so?
Well, when you catch yourself making elaborate excuses for why you failed at something, maybe that's rationalization. Or when you find yourself unfairly blaming your partner for a feeling of frustration that's actually coming from work, maybe that's projection. Simply noticing these patterns, naming them.
It makes you pause and think, wait, what's really going on here?
Exactly. It helps you move towards a more honest self-assessment, to understand your real motivations a bit better, rather than just accepting the convenient story your ego is telling you.
Okay, that's useful. What about transference? You mentioned that earlier. How does understanding that help?
Oh, immensely. Especially in professional and personal dynamics. Think about it. Have you ever had a really strong, maybe disproportionate reaction, positive or negative, to someone you've just met, like a new boss or a teacher or even a colleague?
Yeah. Sometimes you instantly click with someone or instantly dislike them for no obvious reason.
Right. That might be unconscious transference at play. You could be unconsciously redirecting feelings, expectations, or patterns of relating from an important figure in your past, like a critical parent or a beloved mentor, onto this new person. They somehow remind you unconscious of that past figure.
So if I find myself feeling oddly intimidated by a new manager who hasn't actually done anything intimidating,
it could be because they unconsciously remind you of, say, a stern father figure. Recognizing that possibility allows you to step back and ask, is my reaction based on this person here and now, or am I reacting to a ghost from my past? It helps you separate the present reality from your emotional baggage.
That allows for much more objective and fair interactions. That's incredibly practical.
It really is. And beyond specific concepts, Storr's whole approach as critical thinking provides a valuable model for how to evaluate any complex, influential set of ideas. How to appreciate the profound insights while also recognizing the limitations, the biases, the flawed methodology.
Separating the baby from the bathwater, essentially.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So as we wrap up, what's your final takeaway from revisiting Freud through Storr's lens? What stands out most to you?
For me, it's really Storr's nuanced verdict. He paints Freud as this incredibly courageous, genuinely revolutionary pioneer who opened up a whole new continent for exploration of the unconscious mind. But he was also human. He was dogmatic at times, limited by his era, made significant errors.
So the lesson isn't just about Freud, but about how we engage with big thinkers generally.
I think so. The most valuable lesson for me is the importance of maintaining that balanced perspective. Mature intellectual engagement isn't about blind worship or wholesale rejection. It requires us to grapple with complexity, to accept both the profound insights and the significant flaws in any influential body of thought. Storr models that beautifully.
That's a great point. For me, I'm left thinking about just how enduring Freud's core questions are. Even if his answers were sometimes wrong or culturally bound, the questions he forced us to confront about irrationality, about inner conflict, about the influence of the past, the power of the unconscious to their binary, they're still the big questions we wrestle with today.
They absolutely are.
It's fascinating that the specific theoretical scaffolding can crumble, but the fundamental challenge he laid down, confronting the unsettling, often irrational core of our own being, that remains profoundly relevant. It's a constant reminder, isn't it, that our past is always present within us, that we're always shaped by hidden drives and conflicts.
And the lifelong challenge, perhaps, is to bring more of that hidden house into the light of conscious understanding.
A perfect note to end on.
Aikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Aikatra AI.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Aikatra Foundation.